could you start out and give us a brief bio of yourself?
Well, I was born and raised in rural upstate New York, and my family and even my pretty much the whole community was very conservative politically, meaning Republican, and in some cases, in my own case, even fairly right-wing Republican in terms of political ideology, and very conservative Baptist religious home. So that just kind of sets the tone for growing up in a kind of a small agricultural town. But through high school, I was a good athlete and a good student, went on to college, and was still pretty parochial in my worldviews. I didn't have any other basis upon which to have a different perspective. My family didn't have themselves and their friends have any intellectual discussions that I remember. My family was fairly racist, and they would make comments that would be denigrating to other people, but I don't remember having any real political discussions. After I graduated from college, I went to law school. While I was in law school, I actually got drafted with a school deferment. Even though I didn't think I could be drafted with a school deferment, I was drafted, because the school deferment was a preferential, not an absolute deferment, and there were some 2S school deferred students like myself who were drafted. I believed totally in the war, however, and had no political or philosophical or religious reason to oppose it. I just was not one of those kind of guys that particularly wanted to get shot at or to go to combat. It was all okay for somebody else to do it. Well, when I got drafted, I wound up enlisting in the Air Force as in an officer program, and first 2 years I was at headquarters, Air Force Systems Command in Washington, in the Inspector General's office, a very plush white-collar job. I was thinking, wow, I was really lucky to get that job. But then I got my orders to a special classified mission to Vietnam, preceded by 12 weeks of training at Fort Campbell, Kentucky, in Ranger School, which I really was kind of stunned that I was that there was such a Air Force mission and I was selected for it. Well, I went through the 12 weeks of training and went to Vietnam with 40 men to basically protect air bases. And in our particular case, most of the time we were 100 miles south of Saigon in the Mekong Delta, protecting a very small Vietnamese Air Force base, the base that was the most frequently attacked base of the 10 air bases in Vietnam. It was the only one owned and really operated by the Vietnamese, but we were there to supplement their security system. And while I was there, this was in March and April of 69, I was asked by the Vietnamese commander to accompany one of his lieutenants to villages, or to, actually, I think he stated he wanted me to verify that South Vietnamese pilots were hitting their targets. I did not even think at the time what a target, I just didn't have any visual image of a target and with any specifics, and it turned out that the targets were villages. And so after I witnessed, assessed the very first village, very first target, I was asked to go to examine with this Vietnamese lieutenant. It's about 8 miles from our base. I was in shock because I saw somewhere around probably 130 bodies strewn on the ground in a very small rice farming village, really just a mound in the rice paddies. I didn't see anybody that was on their feet. At least half were dead, and most were, you could tell, those I could identify were young mothers and small children. And I had to do that 4 more times in a matter of like 10 days. And in every case, I witnessed a similar scene. So that pretty much shocked my sensibilities. first, then questioning the war, and then questioning the history of the war, and having had to admit at the time that I was extraordinarily ignorant about the history of Vietnam and the Vietnamese culture, and I was kind of embarrassed in a way because I was, I turned 28 in Vietnam. I was 25 when I was drafted, and I did a four-year assignment in the Air Force, and so I did turn 28 in Vietnam, and I had not really, it didn't seem like I'd had the wherewithal to ask any questions prior to being in that situation, which, you know, in hindsight seems almost inconceivable, but nonetheless, that was a reality in my own case, and I'm sure I wasn't, you know, alone, but I was older than the average soldier over there, and I actually, by the time I got to Vietnam, I had a master's degree, and I was already halfway through law school, so in a way, I didn't have any excuse for the ignorance, but I was nonetheless pretty ignorant about things, and when I had the awakening, shocking experiences of seeing all these civilians, probably 700 or 800 or 900 dead or severely maimed, I just, I've been on a questioning path ever since, and then, so this is 34 years later, so, you know, I've basically been on quite a different path since then.
When you began your questioning over there, was it kind of an internal questioning, or did you have the comfort level where you could ask people directly about what was going on?
Well, no, I was fairly quickly asking questions out loud to my peers, my other officers and superior officers. At the same time, I had got my hands on a history book in English that was in our little library at the Binh Tu Air Base called The United States and Vietnam, written by two Cornell University professors, Cahin and Lewis. I think it was kind of amazing that I found it on the base in the library. And I read that book probably in 3 days and nights when I had moments to read. And that just so confirmed for me my fairly shocking suspicions that something was terribly wrong, because I in reading that history, I discovered that, you know, what anybody that knew anything about history would have already known, that the way the French Indochina War ended with the Geneva Accords in 1954, the agreement was that there would be Vietnamese elections in 1956 to reunify the country that had never really been divided before the French were there after World War II, and that the United States sabotaged those elections and sabotaged the efforts of the Vietnamese to achieve independence, and basically created, manufactured the fiction of a South Vietnamese government separate from what we call the communists. It was really just a tragic fiction which we funded. Well, reading that book after about the time I was visiting these so-called targets, which were villages, I was actually quite explicitly talking about the illegality of the bombings to my superiors, because in officer training school I'd had to study the rules of engagement and the Nuremberg principles that were incorporated into the rules of engagement that explicitly prohibited targeting civilian villagers or their infrastructure as targets. And so I thought I was actually, naively certainly, but I thought I was actually on solid grounds in questioning the bombings, thinking that they were illegal in violation of international law and the agreements that the United States had made. Of course, I was, fairly immediately condemned for my position on that. And at some point in that spring, early summer, they started bringing sedition charges against me. And then I eventually was, after 5 months, was sent home early, sent back to the States, not knowing what was happening, what was going to happen. So I only found one other person while I was there in that 5 months who similarly to me, another officer who wasn't even stationed at Bintuy but was temporarily in transit there from one assignment at where he had been at Tansanute in Saigon as a pilot, and he refused to fly any more missions, and he was somehow at Bintuy for on his way back to the States, and he was probably there for a few days, and he's the only person I met who was similarly outraged by the war and the bombings.
So you came back to the States, and what happened next?
Well, I was still in the military, and the Air Force decided to assign me to a supply squadron in central Louisiana as an executive officer to the chief of supply to a major, and I was assigned an Air Force defense lawyer to prepare for a potential court-martial proceeding, and so I spent my last year in central Louisiana at a small air base just doing my job as a supply squadron executive officer, basically dealing with personnel matters and playing a lot of squadron sports and consulting with my lawyer regularly, you know, kind of scared about what might happen. They were telling me I was going to do 20 years in prison. And they actually brought more charges against me in Louisiana for every weekend I was speaking at various rallies in Louisiana, in civilian clothes, criticizing the war. And the base commander was concerned about the fairly explicit political activities that I was engaged in, but I was doing them when I was certainly not at work and certainly not in uniform. But I got through that year, and there was no court-martial, and I actually became a captain and was discharged honorably, and was just extraordinarily relieved to have escaped 4 years in the military, including that 5 months in Vietnam, without having been court-martialed or even without having been shot by other Americans who I was told was a danger for me in Vietnam, that I might have been eliminated, that was a policy of, you know, an unwritten, unspoken policy of eliminating especially officers who might have been considered traitorous because they were questioning the war, that it was not a safe position to be in. But I got out and was alive and went back to Washington and finished law school and actually participated with Vietnam Veterans Against the War at a big demonstration in Washington in 1971, and basically was on my first chapter of my new life.
So is that where your activist career began, is about that time?
Yeah, although I didn't actually think of myself as an activist in those years. I certainly was active in anti-war demonstrations, but I was not a leader in any organization. And more than not, after I was admitted to the bar in Washington, D.C., I didn't really practice law very long. But I did get very involved in a lot of examination of the criminal justice system in the United States, and I did a lot of prison work and prison reform work all over the country, and I worked for the Unitarian Universal Service Committee for a number of years in that function. So I was kind of an activist in the domestic justice issues, and it wasn't until about 1981, when I had my flashbacks to Vietnam, that I started getting involved in both dealing with my Vietnam experiences emotionally, which I didn't think I was ever going to have to think about again, and then much more involved in understanding U.S. foreign policy. So I started, you know, really getting involved in speaking out at rallies against U.S. policies in Central America, and then I started going to Central America, but that wasn't until the mid-80s.
What's your perception on what brought your flashbacks? Was it what was happening in the world and the country then, or was it just something personal?
Well, at the time, actually, at the very moment the flashback occurred, I was working as a legislative aide to the Massachusetts State Legislature, and I was there kind of their prison investigator for state prisons in Massachusetts, and I was in Walpole State Prison interviewing prisoners who had alleged beatings by guards, and I was I had been there for a number of months, actually, doing this investigation, and on this particular day I had been interviewing prisoners in the worst cell block in the prison all day long, and late in the afternoon I heard a commotion, and I saw at the other end of the cell block guards pulling a prisoner out of a cell and beating on him and stomping on him with both their feet and billy clubs. And for whatever the reason, at that moment I had my flashback, and I was in a village in Vietnam, and I couldn't, I mean, it's a pretty scary thing, because my feet were actually on a tier of a cell block, but in my mind I was walking and standing near bodies and walking over bodies to get out of the prison. Actually, I just had this impulse. I had to immediately exit the situation I was in order to get to a safe place. And I was actually holding on to prison bars lining the runway of the cell block as I was kind of navigating my steps over bodies. You know, I actually was psychically walking through a village full of corpses, and yet I was in a prison in Massachusetts trying to get out to my car. It was pretty, I'd never experienced anything like it, and I didn't know what was happening. It was a full-blown flashback, and it was to a scene that I hadn't really remembered for 12 years. I mean, that's how deeply it had been submerged in my subconscious. And that's when I started going to therapy and rap groups. I mean, I had to do something. I didn't have the foggiest notion what had happened, really, you know, during the flashback. I mean, I just seemed totally off the wall and out of the blue, and yet it was definitely, I know what provoked it, but I don't, certainly don't understand it.
But somehow that further catalyzed your
yeah, activism. It my healing journey required, in my case, apparently, as at least as my system was processing it, required much more deeper understanding of U.S. foreign policy and why we do what we do and why I did what I did without questioning it. So I became really immersed in studying the history of U.S. foreign policy, really going back to the early 1800s, and started traveling to Central America, to Nicaragua and El Salvador, to see for myself what was happening. You know, I'd already learned to decode the language of the media at the time, you know, knowing that when they report that Congress or the President are funding policies to overthrow Marxist-Leninists, language such as that, I'd learned, like lots of others, that that meant killing poor people who were in a struggle for justice. So, you know, and I knew that couldn't possibly be considered a just policy or even a policy that could, in the long run, bring any kind of peace to the Nicaragua or even to ourselves. And so I think one of the things that happens to veterans who go through a recovery process like I was going through, you in some way want to atone for your ignorant participation in the previous war where many people undeservedly were killed. And it's something that certainly, in my case, changed me forever. And when the flashbacks came, I had to deal with it more directly and intimately, because it was out in the open. It was in my conscious mind. It was actually in my body. It was very visceral. So, you know, how I responded was to become knowledgeable or more knowledgeable by about U.S. policies, why they happen, try to educate my fellow and sister citizens about why these policies continue ad nauseum, and why in the long run they cannot bring us peace and justice, because they enrage people by killing them and destroying their aspirations for justice. So I basically started participating in a number of trips to Central America, usually with others and often with other veterans, and just believed that somehow that if enough information was known by other citizens in the United States, they would insist on a change in policy. You know, that in and of itself is to some extent naive, because United States policy has been pretty belligerent for a long time, and there's a good reason for it. You know, when 4.5% of the world's population insist on consuming 25 or 35 or 40% of the world's resources, depending on which resource you examine, you basically have to steal it at gunpoint. You have to take it from other people, because you're living way beyond what is your just due allocation of the resources. Basically 1/20th of the population consuming a fourth to a half the world's resources. That just can't be maintained in any fair way. But of course, we don't grow up understanding that. It's not in the system's interest for anybody to really think about those things. But once you've realized it, you kind of are involuntarily, in a way, thrust out of the American box, at least the American way of thinking, and the way you grew up so comfortably thinking, and you begin discerning on ways to express your own life in a more truthful way and in a healing way. So, you know, that basically has motivated most of my life in the last 25 years.
And during that 25 years, have you felt that U.S. policy and U.S. foreign policy has been getting worse, been maintaining itself at the same level?
Well, I have to say that overall it's gotten much worse, and one of the reasons it's gotten worse is that there is no institutional political force in the world that's able to antidote the unipolar hegemony of the United States since the fall of the Soviet Union. The United Nations is not of sufficient power or credibility to be able to contain the United States. And so the arrogance that we already have had as a culture long before we dropped the atomic bomb, but that just made it even more intense, was further deepened with the fall of the Soviet Union and what we call the failure of socialism, and therefore the logical conclusion is that our system, capitalism, and what we call our constitutional democracy has won this world ideological battle. So the arrogance has enabled us, or has motivated us, to become ever more belligerent. And of course, Clinton was belligerent in his own way, and Bush is now talking in such a fashion that our intention to be imperialistic and hegemonic are just explicitly and proudly stated. And I think that's probably a blessing, because in fact that's what we do have to do, and we might as well be honest about it. And if the American people want to put up with it, then they can continue to support policies such as Bush is proposing. If they don't like it, it's time for a much more vigorous, explicit, and more comprehensive uprising of the people. I don't mean violent uprising, but a much more vigorous expression of dissent, no matter what the government threatens to do. I mean, it's like, in the long run, we have to take responsibility for our government, and it may mean that we have to leave the comfortable paradigm that we've kind of got used to living in, thinking that we can go to the polls every 4 years and think that that's providing us a democratic and fewer people that really are running things, and it's mostly the rich. And there's been a massive redistribution of wealth from the poor to the rich, and somehow the only way that, the only force that can stop that is the American people. So I would say that, you know, all of our efforts over the years, they may be extremely important in the historical evolutionary process of how change happens, not necessarily in the manner in which one would hope, but the historical processes are much bigger than any one of us or any group of us can even comprehend. And I can say that we probably prevented an outright military invasion of Nicaragua with our work in the 80s, but nonetheless we destroyed, the United States destroyed the Nicaraguan Revolution, pretty much, although there's still a revolutionary spirit that's possessed by some of the Nicaraguan people, but certainly the society is back to being a repressive capitalist society, just what the United States wants. And so that's, you know, it's pretty disappointing. It's pretty depressing at times to realize that the forces of monopoly capitalism and the lies of our government, not just our government, but other governments as well in the First World, especially Great Britain, continues to prevail in a way. I don't think that they can prevail for too much longer, but that's my hope. And certainly there is a kind of a percolation, I think, that's happening all over the world, that the New York Times itself last February, when there were 10 or 15 million people marching against the pending war of the U.S. against Iraq, the New York Times said there's now two superpowers, the United States and the people of the world. And I think that is a fairly significant sign. And the question is how many of the people of the United States will, in a sense, experience a paradigm shift of their own that will enable them and empower them to new levels of dissent that will make it more difficult for the United States to continue these policies that are really destined to hurt all of us. I mean, they're not in the best interest of most U.S. Americans any more than they are in the best interests of most people in the world, and certainly they're not in the best interests of maintaining or striving for a healthy ecology that we must have in order to survive on the planet. So, you know, it's kind of a no-brainer to me that some pretty radical changes have to happen, and I'm thinking that there's a lot of people that really do grasp this. But when I think of a lot of my own family members in upstate New York, you know, they're still what I would call pretty dumbed down by watching television. And that's, you know, that can be discouraging.
Yeah, it seems that there's multiple hurdles that we have to get over, one of them being getting the information out to people, which it seems to me that a lot of people have a sense of things being wrong. They don't necessarily have it all spelled out for them, though.
Well, it's true. I mean, you know, there does need to be kind of an understanding of the diagnosis of the problem. What is the problem and why? And so much of the media simply replicates the lines uttered by political leaders. In other words, the mass media basically just serves as a PR organ for a government that's really a plutocracy. But I do have to say this. The policies that Bush and his cabal have articulated, and some of which was already written before they came into power by the Project for New American Century, those policies are exactly what is necessary to continue the American way of life unabated. The Democrats have to, in a sense, believe in the same kind of imperial policies, unless they're willing to step out of the box and say, this is an unsustainable model and it can't continue and we have to articulate an alternative vision. Really, if people want to continue to think of the American way of life as non-negotiable, then we have to be an imperial power, which means that we will probably continue acting in such a manner that we'll destroy the planet and our species on the planet, because our policies really are that destructive. On the other hand, I think there are signs that in the society people are beginning to register, despite the fact that for the most part, the media doesn't help them in this questioning process, in the critical review process. I think there's an increasing number of people that are beginning to sense not only is something terribly wrong, but that perhaps there is even the possibilities of envisioning alternatives. You have to remember that for 30 years we've had a minority of veterans, but nonetheless a number of veterans speaking the truth about the Vietnam War and other wars fairly consistently for 3 decades, and ex-CIA officers who left the agency. That's a fairly new phenomena, I think, in history, where we have an articulate minority of people who are basically dispelling the myths and the lies that all of us grew up believing in, that we discovered only in the midst of participating in some of the dark chapters that the United States has been participating in to maintain this incredible mythology about our superiority and our need for consumption at the level that we consume. So when you start listening to people who have experienced what this requires, it's really kind of demonic, the kind of policies that are required. Then you have more and more people that have been in the inside that are revealing something terrible that they've participated in, and they want to share that with the public. And who knows what 30 and 40 years of accumulation of those little talks and articles and activities around particular policies, they tend, I think, to build up over time towards a new consensus. And I think that Bush has been a catalyst for this, because he's so blatant and so arrogant that he doesn't even feel like he has to be careful what he says that much. And I think that there are people that heretofore might not have gotten it, but now I'm beginning to think, oh my God, this is pretty scary, and I don't know if I want to live with these continuation of these policies, because maybe they are actually going to hurt us, not help us. So, you know, I see hopeful signs, but I also know that there's, in my mind, from my studies, the Earth cannot sustain 6.3 billion people using petroleum in order to facilitate our way of life. Not only is the petroleum going to run out at some point, but we just cannot healthfully live with all the other species and with the ecosystem that's now out of balance. We just can't live with the number of people we have, so there's going to likely be catastrophic events that will conceivably be accompanied by quantum leaps in human consciousness. And I don't think we're talking about the distant future. I think we're talking about something that's going to happen in our lifetimes. It's going to be dramatic and catastrophic and conceivably even uplifting all at the same time.
Do you see perhaps the situation currently in Iraq as being something that could be a catalyst?
Yes. You know, I think that it's a quagmire that, because of our history of pride not being, which is kind of a form of maintaining denial about reality, I think the quagmire that we're in Iraq and even in Afghanistan has occurred fairly quickly in the time period that we've been involved there, compared to, for example, Vietnam, where I think the quagmire wasn't really recognized by most people for probably 4 or 5 years after we started our involvement there militarily. And so I think the quagmire, and there's 3 more soldiers killed today, I think that it's probably going to lead to the collapse of, I think it's conceivable that it will lead to the collapse of this whole imperial model, because it's happening at the same time that most of the world understands how sick our model is and our values, our political values, and increasing numbers of people in the United States being awakened to something being terribly wrong. Plus, our economy is not in good shape, and who knows when that's going to manifest in more dramatic ways for larger numbers of middle-class people. And Iraq going to drain us economically as well as be a political huge faux pas. And we know from all the information that's even come out with the major media about the fraud of the whole pretext in which we went to Iraq. I mean, that kind of indicates there's no foundation to the policy that can withstand constant critiquing. And there also will likely be a number of soldiers that who will increasingly demonstrate a kind of dissent and kind of a disheartened morale that will make it perhaps almost impossible to even continue an occupation of Iraq at some point in the next year. And I think they're talking now about an occupation that perhaps is going to be necessary until 2006. Our inability to understand other cultures and how other cultures experience our intervention and our shock that people might feel rage towards our behavior, that alone will trip us up. Because, you know, arrogance tends to be blind, and it's already proving to be the case in Iraq and even in Afghanistan, where the Taliban now are increasingly in control of the countryside. The people that we originally put in power, who we then went to war to get out of power, I mean, it's so crazy that I think it all has to collapse. I'm not going to underestimate the resilience of plutocratic power and capitalism, but I also know that our system is not sustainable. It's not sustainable ecologically, economically, politically, socially. It has too much dysfunctionality intrinsic to its own nature. And so it doesn't mean that we're going to have smooth sailing if we have a collapse of the Bush administration or even of our system as we know it, but it can't continue as it is because it's too pathological.
It seems that another one of the big hurdles that we need to leap over is our citizens' fear, and it's fear of a lot of things. I mean, the U.S. at a national level appears to be afraid of almost every country, every, you know, these perceived enemies, and then there's the personal fear of individuals knowing that something is wrong, yet being afraid to speak out, even amongst friends and acquaintances.
Well, there's no question that fear is a huge issue. You know, it's an ancient emotion that has, that's part of our evolutionary journey. It's probably one of the first emotions that our ancestors experienced in their survival, and we have plenty of things to allow oneself to feel scared of, especially being in a society that wants to continue to dominate the world's resources, meaning that one has to continue to justify that you deserve more resources than other people. And it kind of breeds a kind of paranoia that other people are out to get you, and that in fact is somewhat the case, because we do a lot of things to maintain our way of life that are harmful to others and also that deprive others of a way of life. So one of the ways for dealing with fear is to try to become honest, and that usually requires either a painful experience or a group of people to sort things out with, whether it be in school or church or just a study group or just friends. Because fear gets worse if you don't deal with the issues head on. And, of course, fear will inconceivably kill us. Just as FDR once said, there's nothing much worse than fear itself. And the therapeutic way to deal with fear is to embrace the object of the fear in some way, honestly. Whether it's a fear of race or sex or ideology or religion, not to continually run from it or repress it, because then it will come out even more screwy and often violent in a violent way without addressing, without really correcting any of the problems. So I think think that fear definitely has to be acknowledged. It's definitely an issue, and certainly the government knows how to manipulate policies by nourishing fear, by inducing fear. And I think, you know, we have a way of life that we're afraid we might have to give up some of it, or we might have to change it in a way that's, you know, so we're dealing with unfamiliarity. But there's only one way out, and that is, in my mind, and that is to embrace it directly and to look at the problems more honestly. This is one thing the media could certainly be a big help. Can't count on the government to do it, but we could count on some of the media to be more independent in terms of getting to the bottom of what are the sources of problems, where are the origins of problems, what's the history of the problems. And I think there's a lot of citizens that are doing it on their own or in small groups or in their organizations. So I think the more people that are willing to embrace the fear or embrace the causes of the fear and look at them more closely, the more other people will feel empowered to do the same and realize that fear will kill us if we don't deal with it more constructively. But certainly it has to be acknowledged as an issue, and we ought to be acknowledging that the government knows that it's a great tool for them in maintaining their sense of hegemony and their sense of omnipotence and their sense of imperialism, really, that they can keep us all sedated by telling us that we have to use duct tape and be constantly on our watch for somebody that's going to hurt us. Well, that is the way to assure that sooner or later we're going to get hurt really bad, because that's the kind of paranoid thinking that leads to not only imagining dangers, but forcing you to live in such a way that you're not really living the way you really want to live, and therefore become unhappier and unhappier and more at the mercy of whoever's manipulating the information and keeping the hysteria of fear at such a level that people won't be willing to address it or deal with it because they're just paralyzed with their fear. So I believe if people can perceive danger, if people can really perceive danger, which is not always clear that in the world of sophisticated public relations that we are able to necessarily perceive the danger, because we fool ourselves with our own forms of denial through language and public relations. But historically, when we can perceive fear, we even have a mechanism for responding to save ourselves from, or to avoid the danger as much as possible. It's called adrenaline. And it doesn't even necessarily function cognitively. You respond, I learned in war, you tend to respond with an ancient mechanism for survival that you actually can change your behavior fairly quickly, actually quite radically and rapidly, in order to save your life. And if we can perceive that our policies are endangering our lives, such as maintaining grotesque injustice in the world or in our own society, that in the long run will create systems or settings and situations where we're likely to be considered an enemy to people who are deprived and in misery. So I think if we can enable ourselves to see the dangers that our hegemonic policies are creating for us, then that will also enable people to overcome their fear of rejection or change and say, my life's at stake and I have to do something different than what I've been doing. I don't know, you know, I think we are on the eve of something that's fairly huge, and I'm no prophet, so I can't predict how it's going to look, but I think we're on the eve of a zeitgeist moment, and it's going to both be catastrophic and also inspirational.
And one of the things that you do with your activism to help be a catalyst for this change is you do speaking engagements in different towns, and I know you're going to be coming to Seattle on November the 11th.
Right.
Do you have any plans for what you're going to be discussing?
Well, you know, I never quite know what I'm going to say until I start talking. I think the title is Waging Unconditional Peace. You know, I'll talk about some of my experiences and how I've come to see the world in a way that I do, which is both hopeful and also scary, perhaps. And probably talk, you know, about our current situation and where that fits in an evolutionary context, because we are products of 7 million years of our own evolution, and in the universe that's been evolving for 14 billion years, and that's not insignificant when we're looking at major historical shifts. Kind of makes man-made institutions that are not working well seem like maybe they're very temporary, and that we can, if we created institutions that are dysfunctional, we can create new ones that are more healthy.
And one other thing I was made aware of that you're involved with is an organization I believe you co-founded called the Santa Cruz Film Foundation. Is that correct?
Yeah, the Santa Cruz Film Foundation is, we're working on our first documentary. It's called Divided Country, Disposable People. It's the history of U.S. intervention in Korea, which is kind of an unknown story in the West. I will probably talk about that some also because of its current interest, what's happening in Korea. And the film goes into this whole history of how the U.S. decided to replace the Japanese after World War II, which then created the Civil War, which then led to the Korean War, but it's never really presented in any accurate way, certainly not to me and most of the people I know in the United States, and not even in Europe. We've been to Korea 8 times doing filming, and we've been all over the country interviewing other people. So I'm hoping that that film will be completed in early 2004. We've got 120 hours of footage, and most of it's already logged, but we're still getting a little more footage. I also have a website that people can read essays on, which is brianwilson.com, and you have to know that Wilson is spelled with two L's.
And again, support for your film project, are you guys looking for financial support?
Yeah, we're pretty broke. It is a not-for-profit film company, so people can contribute to it, you know, with a tax deduction. I'm a terrible fundraiser, so I don't even often like to think about money, but it is true that without some more funds, we can't finish the film.
So could they get funds to you through your website?
You know, I don't even know if I have my film address on there. They certainly could make a check to Santa Cruz Film Foundation and send them to me, you know, at my address in California.
Well, are there any last words you would like to leave our listeners with?
I think that we're at a pivotal moment in human history, and it's going to depend, the future's going to depend on what we, especially we North Americans, do with our lives and with our consciences. And I'm thinking that a lot of the listeners probably in the Seattle area are already thinking along these lines, but I think I want to encourage people to consider that this is one of the most incredible opportunities in world history for a radical shift that conceivably can salvage the human species, even with global warming, which is going to dramatically change our lives. So I'm interested in people becoming empowered and envisioned to walk a different path, and certainly we need the alternative vision along with the hope to carry us through, I think, pretty difficult times that we're going to be facing this decade, but that we are totally capable of making the changes.